Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Chris Cowdley, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to thank you for joining us today for Diagnostic and Therapeutic Advances in PBC, Maximizing Opportunities to Improve Patient Care and Outcomes. This CME activity is supported by an educational grant from Gilead Sciences. Today, we may be discussing a few agents currently in development. We will let you know when we are speaking off-label or referring to investigational products. CME Outfitters is a jointly accredited provider and develops and certifies continuing education activities for the team by the team, including our program today. Again, I'm Chris Cowdley. I'm director at the Liver Center at Liver Institute Northwest and professor at Elson S. Floyd College of Medicine, Washington State University. And I'm based in Seattle, Washington. I'm very pleased to be joined by a superb panel who I would ask to introduce themselves, starting with Dr. Ghulam Hussain.
Hi there. My name's Aliyah Ghulam Hussain. I'm a hepatologist and clinical investigator at the Toronto Centre for Liver Disease in Toronto, with a particular interest in cholestatic and autoimmune liver disease, including PBC, PSC, and autoimmune hepatitis.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tuesday Werner. I'm a nurse practitioner at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, and I've been taking care of patients with liver disease for over 20 years.
Thank you both. I should also note we'll be hearing a few pre-recorded perspectives from Maria Moraes, who is living with PBC post-liver transplant. Maria is also a registered nurse and vice president of patient advocacy for the Canadian Society. Here are our learning objectives for today's activity. We would like to assess the burden of PBC. We would like to implement evidence-based strategies for early and accurate diagnosis of PBC and incorporate contemporary clinical pathways for treating PBC patients that considers mechanism of action of different therapeutic agents, indications for their use, efficacy, and safety. So now let's turn to Dr. Ghulam Hussain for the burden of PBC.
Thank you, Dr. Cowdley. So this section will address our first learning objective, the burden of PBC, and will include a bit of an assessment of disease risk. But first, let's get our audience involved with a question. So what percentage of patients with PBC are incomplete responders to ursodeoxycholic acid, or UDCA? Is it 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, or you just don't know? So feel free to go ahead and select your answer of choice, and we'll review the results momentarily. So look at that. So we have about 10% of, about 9% of people that have suggested 10%, about the same for 20%. 21% of 30%, and then 15.2% of 40%, which is the correct answer. So actually about 40% of patients with PBC are suboptimal or incomplete responders to ursodeoxycholic acid. And that really depends on the criteria for response that you choose. But in general, this 40% number is a good number to keep in the back of your head. And before I go through some of the data on the burden of PBC, let's hear a brief introduction from our patient voice, Maria Murray. So go ahead and roll the clip, please.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here with you today and a pleasure to be in this session with you. I am a liver transplant patient. I received a liver from a living donor and a really good friend of mine after suffering with end-stage liver disease due to PBC. So I am a registered nurse now for over 32 years and mostly working in the area of public health, chronic disease prevention, and I'm a people leader, and most recently focusing on mental health promotion. So, you know, it's really interesting to me because never did I think that I'd be on the other side of a chronic illness as a patient dealing with a rare autoimmune disease such as PBC. So it has been a life-changing journey for me, for sure. And I've been sharing my lived experience through sessions, research projects, and as part of my role on the Canadian PBC Society.
Thank you, Maria. So this is a disease that obviously has a significant impact on quality of life. Now, here we see a snapshot of PBC epidemiology, with graphs showing you the incidence and prevalence in different regions over time. So you can see the incidence of PBC generally tended to rise across the world until about 2000, and then seems to have plateaued, whereas the prevalence has continued to rise as patients have aged and as our diagnostic abilities have improved. So here's a visual of the temporal trends in age and disease stage. And this was data that was published by the Global PBC Study Group that showed changes in the epidemiologic profile of patients with PBC over time, such that we've noticed that patients are presenting with a more mild disease phenotype and at an older age. So you can see the curves rising in terms of age at diagnosis, and a higher proportion of patients in the bar graphs on the right presenting with more mild biochemical changes, such as lower alkaline phosphatase levels and lower relative bilirubin levels. But not all PBC is the same, and I think it's really important for us to manage and look at each individual patient that comes in front of us. There are poor outcomes in different subsets of patients, and here you'll see a chart that shows that there are certain phenotypes of patients that may be associated with a higher risk of disease. For example, patients of Indigenous backgrounds, those that are male, where PBC might not be suspected because it's such a female predominant disease, and those who are not treated with ursodeoxycholic acid may have a worse prognosis. And not only is disease stage different amongst different phenotypes of patients, such as ethnicity, but symptoms may be different as well. So this was data that was published out of the Canadian group that also shows that symptom burden can be different across different ethnicities, with, in general, patients of Aboriginal descent presenting with more significant symptoms, be that fatigue, pruritus, impairments in quality of life, however you measure it, be that with standardized questionnaires such as an SF-36 or a PBC-40. So I think it's important to have an approach to characterization of disease risk. And I think if you think of things in this framework, you'll be pretty well set to think of the basic principles of understanding a patient with PBC's risk of disease progression. So you think of a patient's age in general, an age of less than 50 at diagnosis, their biochemical response to standard therapy with ursodeoxycholic acid or their biochemical profiles, and then their fibrosis stage, be that with histology or biochemical markers, which we'll talk about moving forward. We know that treatment with ursodeoxycholic acid, the foundation of treatment is with ursodeoxycholic acid, and all patients with PBC should be treated with therapy. And that should be lifelong, because this data shows that even patients who have a suboptimal response to ursodeoxycholic acid still derive benefit in terms of transplant-free survival. So you can see that the survival curves between patients who have an incomplete response to urso are different to those who are untreated. And those who even have an incomplete response to urso derive survival benefit, so should ensure to continue on therapy. But patients who have a suboptimal response to urso are at risk of reaching poor outcomes. And these are curves that have been presented multiple times, but just show the survival of patients who have a suboptimal response being inferior to those who respond to therapy based on traditional response criteria. So biochemical response criteria are certainly important to consider when assessing someone's disease risk. And this is another study, a seminal paper that was presented by the Global PBC Study Group, again, that identified validated surrogates of outcome in patients with PBC and identified the alkaline phosphatase level and the bilirubin level as important biochemical markers that could be used earlier in the disease trajectory to predict a patient's outcome. And this was really what was foundational in allowing drug development moving forward and bringing us to the point where we have several therapies available for patients with PBC. So in addition to biochemical response, age at diagnosis is another thing that I think is important to consider when assessing someone's disease risk. And this data shows that age is an important predictor of outcome. So you can see the survival curves of patients who are younger with PBC being much different to those of the standard population within the same age group. And that's particularly true for those who are less than 50 at diagnosis. And these patients essentially have to live with their disease for many years, many decades. And as such, their risk of an outcome is higher. The last thing I think it's important to think about when assessing someone's disease risk is their fibrosis stage. And it really doesn't matter how you think about fibrosis stage, be that histologically, biochemically, or with transient elastography, as I'll show you in the slide in the next slide. But assessing someone's disease risk with fibrosis stage is important. And this data shows that, as would be expected, patients who have increased fibrosis or advanced fibrosis, either fibrosis stage 3 or 4, do much more poorly than those with earlier stages of fibrosis, even if they have a biochemical response to URSO. This is also seen when assessing fibrosis stage with liver stiffness, so a non-invasive approach to identifying degree of fibrosis. And these thresholds, I think, are valuable at thinking about disease risk, such that you can think about a low-risk patient as someone who has a liver stiffness measurement of about 8 or less, someone at high risk of disease progression or disease outcome with a liver stiffness of greater than or equal to 15, and sort of a moderate risk of disease at a level in between those two thresholds. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll pass the mic on back to Dr. Cowdley.
Thank you, Dr. Ghulam Hussain. That was a great summary of both how we assess response to UDCA and the importance of risk stratification and stage assessment at the same time in making decisions about second line therapy. So with that, I want to now turn to Dr. Werner to take a closer look at how PBC is diagnosed. So Dr. Werner, please take it away.
Thank you, Dr. Cowdley. Thank you everyone for spending your precious time with us tonight. This section will address our second learning objective, implement evidence-based strategies for early and accurate diagnosis of PBC. So before I proceed, here is our second of the three audience response questions. So if you suspect a patient may have a PBC, what should be checked as a first step in the diagnostic pathway? Is it A, anti-nuclear antibody or ANA? B, anti-mitochondrial antibody or AMA, C, GP201 or SP100, D, liver biopsy, or E, you don't know. So go ahead and register your answer now. So the results are in. So 12.2% answered ANA, AMA or anti-mitochondrial antibody 41.5%, 4.9% on anti-glycoprotein or anti-speckled protein, 100, and liver biopsy, 2.4%, and I don't know. So the correct answer is B, anti-mitochondrial antibody, commonly referred to as AMA, and we'll hear more about it here in a little bit. So how do PBC present in the clinic? So PBC, as we all know, is a chronic cholestatic autoimmune liver disease characterized by a destructive small duct and lymphocytic cholangitis and marked by the presence of AMA. It is thought to be caused by combination of genetic predisposition and environmental triggers such as nail polish, hair dye, and cigarette smoking, xenobiotics. I think I use most of them. And it is one of the most common, one of the common rare disease according to the CDC and INH, and that most clinicians will encounter PBC in clinical practice. BBC is typically identified in middle age, as Dr. Presented earlier, and it's exceptionally rare under 25 years of age. Modern literature has demonstrated that although PBC remains a female-predominant disease, it's also prevalent in males, and as we previously thought. PBC in males mostly diagnosed at the older age, and once the disease is more advanced, there's greater progression to cirrhosis, higher rates of liver-related death or transplantation, and increased risk for HCC or hepatocellular carcinoma. So patients with PBC often present in the clinic with no symptoms or to a wide variety of or array of symptoms like fatigue, intense itching or pruritus, dry eyes and mouth or Sika syndrome, abdominal pain, and sometimes subtle signs like yellowing of the skin or jaundice in advanced stages, along with potential findings on physical exam like enlarged liver, hepatomegaly, fatty deposition in the eyes, and skin hyperpigmentation. Now, being said that, fatigue is the most common complaint and is experienced by up to 80% of patients during the disease course and often rated as the most disabling PBC symptom. Pruritus closely follows in frequency and may be associated with sleep deprivation, worsening fatigue, depression, social isolation, and self-mutilation, and thus leading to a significant impairment in quality of life. Now, asymptomatic patients incidentally noted to have elevated ALP-FOS or total bilirubin will require more blood tests and check for AMA. So really, prompt diagnosis and timely management and treatment is critical to prevent liver-related sequelae, right? Cirrhosis and need for transplantation and death. So this is from our very own Dr. Cowdley with regards to diagnostic delays. According to him, as addressed to PBC patient, you know that those symptoms that you think maybe are in your head, they're not. It's real, and you need to make sure that you speak up for yourself. The symptoms of PBC may not be immediately obvious and may be dismissed by clinicians without experience for caring for PBC. So really, the delay in diagnosis of PBC is common because the disease often develops slow and with subtle symptoms, and patients can have the condition for years before noticing any issues. And even then, the symptoms can be easily mistaken for other conditions, leading to a significant delay in diagnosis, particularly in men, resulting in more advanced liver damage by the time of diagnosis is made. So really, the key points of delayed diagnosis of PBC, it's asymptomatic and early signs. It comes with nonspecific symptoms like fatigue and itching, which are common in PBC, but can also be caused by other conditions, making it more challenging to diagnose. There's gender disparity. Women are much more likely to develop PBC than men. And although the studies suggest men may experience a longer delay in diagnosis. And also there's lack of awareness. Some healthcare providers may not be familiar with PBC, which can lead to misdiagnosis and delayed referral to specialists. So before I continue, let's check with our patient, Maria. Again, about her PBC symptoms and diagnostic journey.
So symptoms is something that's always on PBC patients' minds. We often experience the disease in very unique ways. There's no one characteristic of a PBC patient, although there are common symptoms and severity. So I think common symptoms that we often hear are fatigue and the itch, just this tiredness and brain fog, perhaps, where, you know, patients experience sort of this fatigue that is not normal everyday exhaustion, or, you know, I'm just feeling tired because I had a busy day, whether we're moms, we've got careers, we're taking care of other family members and generations. So for me, my disease symptoms were more on the extreme side, extreme fatigue, this relentless itching. I then had severe ascites, which is fluid in my abdomen. That was sort of the tipping point, as well as the hepatic encephalopathy. I started falling a couple of times. My memory and cognitive functioning was really impaired. I was working at the time as a people leader, so in the healthcare system during COVID. So I needed to be sharp and I just wasn't. So I had to give that up.
Thank you, Maria. So for diagnosis of PBC, it can summarize on this slide. So when seeing a patient with cholestasis in the clinic, initial assessment, obviously we evaluate the patient based on history and physical examination. We look at the laboratory investigations and abdominal ultrasound. So with a history, we carefully exclude other drug exposure and presence of coexistent autoimmune conditions in the patients and also their families. We look at the physical examination, including skin evaluation for any excoriations, screen for hepatomegaly, splenomegaly, and extrahepatic signs of advanced liver disease. And we look at the laboratory tests, excluding other causes of liver diseases. So the assessment of patient with cholestasis, whether they're symptomatic or not, should include liver ultrasound and testing for AMA in the serum. A positive AMA is sufficient to make the diagnosis of PBC. For negative AMA serology, ANA positive, PBC-specific ANA, such as the anti-SP100 and anti-GP210, can aid in the diagnosis of PBC. Liver biopsy is reserved for those with unclear diagnosis after serologic workup or when coexisting processes is suspected, including fatty liver disease or autoimmune hepatitis. Imaging studies like ultrasound or MRI may be used as well to rule out other causes of liver abnormalities or obstructions. And then check for conditions like that will mimic almost same symptoms as PBC, such as PSC or primary sclerosing cholangitis, progressive familial intrahepatic cholestasis or PFIC, and IgG4. So this is the summary of the AASLD guideline for the criteria of diagnosing PBC. So according to the guideline, two of three must be met, including biochemical evidence of cholestasis based on ALP elevation, the presence of AMAs or other PBC-specific autoantibodies, including SP100 and GP210, if AMA is negative, and histopathologic evidence of non-supportive destructive cholangitis and destruction of interlobular bile ducts if biopsy is performed. Mm-hmm. Again, we have to exclude other possible differential diagnoses like cholestatic drug reaction, biliary obstruction, autoimmune hepatitis, and PSC. And also we use transient elastography to assess for liver stiffness. Liver biopsy are, again, not required in most cases, but can be helpful in cases without certain diagnosis by evaluating the concomitant conditions. And also, it holds a prognostic value based on disease activity and fibrosis stage. So let's talk about the racial and ethnic disparities in PBC, as mentioned earlier. So this is like a study looking at the race, ethnicity, and insurance-specific disparities of patients with PBC who were hospitalized between 2007 to 2014. And basically, this looking for the racial difference and health care disparities influence survival in patients with PBC. So there's about 18,000 patients that were hospitalized included in the study with PBC. 15% were male and mean age was 63.8 and 41% were cirrhotic. And so basically the study showed that the Black and Hispanic patients have significantly higher risk of waitlist mortality with hazard ratio of 1.26 and 1.41 respectively, and removal from the transplant list due to the clinical deterioration compared with whites. Ethnic disparities are also evident in terms of in-hospital mortality for PBC patients. And in addition, the study pointed disparities suggest that the ethnic minorities with PBC often have more severe disease presentation compared to non-Hispanic white and limited access to care issues, that potential disparities in treatment could contribute to poorer outcomes in minority population with PBC. So with regards to this SDOH or social determinants of health, it's very important to ask or assess these patients with this, because we know that in the context of managing PBC, including all these non-medical factors that can impact health outcomes and can also play in the role in the diagnosis and treatment of PBC. So it can help us understand the complex relationship between the environment, social classifications, and can significantly impact how we take care of these patients and improve their outcomes. So we look at factors like income level, education, access to healthcare, the neighborhood quality, the racial and ethnic background. All these can influence disease management, treatment adherence, and overall quality of life. So question is, how do we go about with this? So as stated earlier, the treatment paradigm of PBC has shifted from wait to fail, where we diagnose PBC, we give them also monitored response to 12 months. And we do this shift to a more personalized, holistic care with aspirational, attainable goals using therapies targeted to patient profiles, such as their liver function tests, liver fibrosis, symptoms and risk factors, along with working with the patient through education and their education about their risk and achieving normal liver function tests, hopefully resolve fibrosis, improve quality of life, no liver transplant, and ultimately, hopefully, PBC cure. So where do we start when we see our patients at the clinic? We can start this holistic care by meaning addressing almost everything that we can and ask patients to have an open communication to attain this goal. Simple questions like, what are your challenges when it comes to going to your appointments? Do you have any preference for time? Do you want to be seen telehealth or in person? Do you have access to any pharmacy at all? Or do you have any preferred languages? Do you need interpreter? Do you need social services to help you? Do you have insurance? So all these things matter. So if we can put this to as part of our care, that will be the start. So recognizing and increasing awareness of any hindrance, possible obstacle in caring for our patients with PBC is necessary to be able to implement solution, have a consistency, and continue to provide quality care. Thank you. Back to you, Dr. Cowley.
Well, thank you, Dr. Werner, for really getting everyone up to date on diagnosis and a patient-centered approach to care. And increasingly, I find that the patients with PBC in my practice are looking to our clinic as being their medical home. So we're the ones that remind the PCP to order bone density. We're the ones checking fat-soluble vitamin levels. We're the ones reminding the PCP to measure thyroid hormone levels, et cetera. So extremely helpful. So we're going to move on now. And in the next section, we're going to address our last learning objective, which is incorporate contemporary clinical pathways for treating PBC that considers the mechanism of action, indications, efficacy, and safety. So here we have a poll question. And the poll question is, which of the following was shown with seladelpar in the RESPONSE trial? A durable biochemical response, increased ALP normalization, reduction in pruritus, a transient biochemical response, increased ALP normalization, improvement in brain fog, sustained positive antimitochondrial antibody, reduction in pruritus, complete remission of PBC. 78% of patients receiving 5 milligrams of seladelpar met the composite endpoint, or I don't know. Please make your choices now. Okay, the results are in, and we find that The top answer was, I don't know. So that's wonderful in that you are all here to move from the I don't know category to the correct answer, which is actually A, which 19.4% selected, which is durable biochemical response, increased ALP normalization, reduction in pruritus. And so the key features of seladelpar in the response trial were that 62% of patients treated with seladelpar at 10 milligrams a day compared to 20% of patients treated with seladelpar placebo achieved the composite biochemical response. 25% of patients achieved normalization, and seladelpar was uniquely positive in a statistically significant reduction in itch in patients with moderate to severe pruritus at 6 months. So with that, let's move on. We need new therapies beyond UDCA and obeticholic acid. That's pretty clear. And if you look at first-line therapy with UDCA, about 25 to 50% of patients do not have a biochemical response, and about 5 to 10% of patients will be intolerant. Non-responders have a five-fold progression to cirrhosis and a three-fold increase in age-adjusted mortality. Adverse events clearly negatively impact quality of life. Obeticholic acid was approved in 2016 as second-line therapy based on the composite endpoint of alkaline phosphatase reduction with at least a 15% drop and normalization of bilirubin. But in May of 2021, there was a warning added to obeticholic acid because of the recognition that some patients, particularly those with advanced disease, advanced liver disease, had decompensation or evidence of drug-induced liver injury. So this warning was added for patients with cirrhosis and clinically significant portal hypertension and for patients with decompensated cirrhosis. And this led to a revised guidance from the AASLD. And then a FDA advisory panel was convened in September of 2024 to evaluate full approval of obeticholic acid, which was previously approved based on a surrogate endpoint for conditional approval, as have the other medications that I'm going to discuss also. The panel voted that the confirmatory trial did not verify the clinical benefit and raised some concerns about benefit versus risk. And we also recognize that one of the side effects of obeticholic acid is pruritus, which may lead to discontinuation in some patients. So with that, before I continue, let's hear one more time from Maria Moraes about her lived experience with PBC and the therapies that she has used. Please roll the video.
I think for many PBC patients that were diagnosed many years ago, because the Canadian PBC Society has celebrated their 20th anniversary a few years ago, 2 years ago perhaps, and so there are patients that were, you know, placed on URSO, and that there's so many other options since then. And from what I understand and hear part of these conferences that I've attended, is that there's so many other options being studied and treatments that have been approved. So there's an excitement about when are other treatments coming to Canada. So knowing that worldwide there are many efforts and many pharmaceutical companies look like invested in PBC is very inspiring for PBC patients. Now, knowing that is one thing, but having immediate access like right now is another thing. So I think, you know, that gap, we have to work hard and support and tell our, you know, unmet needs in the areas that we live in, so that we can have that access to treatments or treatment options, right?
So I want to review sort of the treatment pathways. I alluded to UDCA and obeticholic acid, and generally the recommendations are to start UDCA at 13 to 15 milligrams per kilogram per day, then assess the response using alkaline phosphatase and bilirubin, and then assess the GLOBE score in 12 months, as was reviewed by Dr. Ghulam Hussain. And then for patients who are incomplete responders or who are intolerant, those are the patients for whom we would be considering other therapies such as obeticholic acid. So we talked about UDCA, we talked about OCA and the potential limitation with OCA, and we heard from Maria and her point of view. So very exciting news. We had two new therapies approved under the conditional approval pathway in 2024. And so 2024 was a very good year for patients living with PBC. Seladelpar, a PPAR delta agonist, was approved in August. And in June, before that, elafibranor, a dual PPAR agonist for alpha and delta agonism, was also approved. And I'd like to kind of review with you now the results with these studies. So the RESPONSE trial was a study that was a phase 3 trial, and it used the same study design as had been used for the pivotal POISE trial for OCA, and that is patients who had an alkaline phosphatase greater than 1.67 times upper limit of normal, but had a bilirubin less than 2, were enrolled and randomized to treatment with seladelpar versus placebo. And biochemical response with this composite endpoint was evaluated at 12 months. And as I mentioned earlier, 62% versus 20% responded. So that was highly statistically significant. And shown on the right of the slide are the safety findings associated with seladelpar. And seladelpar was associated with a higher incidence of gastrointestinal side effects, such as abdominal pain, abdominal distension, nausea, et cetera. The total population here was 193 patients, and they were randomized 2-to-1. Now, we just presented the three-year open-label treatments with seladelpar as a late-breaker abstract at the American Association for Study of Liver Disease. And what this slide shows is that the response to seladelpar is sustained and durable. And furthermore, with continued therapy, a higher rate of alkaline phosphatase can be observed in patients as they are continued. So shown on the bottom of the slide is the percent change from baseline, showing a brisk and prompt reduction in alkaline phosphatase as early as 4 weeks into treatment. And even more reassuringly, an improvement in pruritus over the course of treatment. Now, elafibranor was also studied and used the same inclusion criteria, which is patients had an elevated alkaline phosphatase greater than 1.67 times upper limit of normal, and they were enrolled with a goal of improving the alkaline phosphatase to less than 1.67 times upper limit of normal with a normal bilirubin and at least a 15% reduction. And as shown on the upper left slide, you can see that 51% of patients with elafibranor achieved this result compared to 4% of patients with placebo, and that was also highly statistically significant. Similarly, there was a higher rate of alkaline phosphatase than what we had seen previously with OCA, and 15% of patients treated with elafibranor achieved alkaline phosphatase normalization. Now, when you look at the change in itch shown on the bottom left, there is in fact a trend towards improvement in itch with elafibranor, but this was not statistically significant. And there were some other measures of itch that also suggested similar trends. And you can see that the percent change in alkaline phosphatase is similar and brisk with a prompt reduction within 4 weeks of treatment. Side effects shown on the upper right here include any adverse events. And once again, most of the adverse events that we observed with elafibranor, which is true with this class of medication in general, were gastrointestinal, with abdominal pain, diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting being the main GI side effects. So in conclusion, for patients with PBC in whom UDCA was not associated with an adequate response, elafibranor as seladelpar showed statistically significant improvements in alkaline phosphatase response, the composite endpoint, and both medications showed improvement in alkaline phosphatase normalization. But of course, these are not head-to-head studies. We have some data with the ELATIVE study with a similar open label extension, and patients who were randomized to elafibranor were allowed to enter an open label extension that measured fatigue and sleep domains to measure the impact of quality of treatment on quality of life, and clinically meaningful improvements were shown with elafibranor treatment in patients with moderate to severe fatigue or excessive sleepiness at baseline. So we're starting to see for the first time now therapies where, in fact, there may be some alignment between both the disease modification that we hope to achieve with improvement in alkaline phosphatase, as shown very clearly as a therapeutic goal by Dr. Ghulam Hussain, as well as potentially improvement in symptoms, which would be very attractive to our patients and to us. Now, a number of other therapies are currently in development, so it's a very rich area to be working in PBC and hope for patients with PBC. But we have medications that target the FGF19 pathway. We have fibric acid derivatives, bezafibrate, which is not available in the U.S. but available in Canada and Europe, fenofibrate, which is available in the U.S. Other FXR agonists have been studied. NOX inhibitors, such as setanaxib, are in trials, and they seem to be promising as well. And a whole new class of drugs, ileal bile acid transport inhibitors, namely volixibat and linerixibat, are also being studied. And in addition, there's a variety of other mechanisms of action that have been postulated, such as immunomodulatory therapies, et cetera. So we have other therapies I mentioned, particularly IBAT inhibitors are attractive because they are promising from the standpoint of relieving symptoms and potentially in the future with ASBT, which is apical sodium-dependent bile acid transporter inhibitors that may have other organs that that are also the focus of the medication. We may even have disease modification, but certainly volixibat was presented at the recent ASLD and seems promising in an early trial with what is quite attractive is a reduction in serum bile acids as shown in the 16-week outcomes, and it was equally effective at lower dose versus higher dose, and in patients that were responders, a significant percentage improve their bile acid levels. The main side effect of IBAT inhibitors because of secretion and excretion of bile acids in the stool is diarrhea, which may be dose-related in some cases, but usually can be managed with anti-diarrheal medications. So ileal bile acid transporter inhibitors, volixibat, promising. Linerixibat is another medication that is an IBAT inhibitor, and this seems to be much further along in development at the moment. I'm showing you the slides from the GLIMMER study that shows improvements in a variety of different domains with regard to itch as well as quality of life, and we just had a recent press release with results from the ongoing phase 3 GLISTEN trial, achieving its primary endpoint of significant improvement in itch compared to patients who are not receiving that medication. We don't have additional details, but we anticipate that these results will be presented at a major meeting very shortly, and this would be obviously another attractive therapeutic tool for managing patients with PBC who have pruritus. So with that, we have a number of very interesting questions. So I would like to take some time to address those questions. And we'll start with a very simple question, which I think is a good one. Should the AMA test be done sort of empirically for anyone with suspicious symptoms and elevated alkaline phosphatase? And is it expensive? So Dr. Werner, I'm going to ask you to answer that one.
Thank you. I'm not sure how much it costs for the AMA, although if I do see a patient who have been having cholestasis, it's one of the tests that, at least for my clinical area, we can just order and make sure that we are not missing anything. So if patients does have alkaline phosphatase elevation or cholestasis picture, I would probably, well, definitely order one and you know, exclude that.
Yeah, I would like to hear Dr. Guillaume-Sain's thoughts, but basically AMA is now done using an ELISA assay. Mm-hmm. So it's an enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. So it's very inexpensive. It's also relatively insensitive, or rather nonspecific. And so there are patients that you sometimes see with a positive AMA who have no suspicion for PBC. They may have done this as an elevated ALT workup. And occasionally patients get this done for whatever reason and their liver tests are normal. In that situation, I think it's less important to pursue it clinically, but certainly any patient with a high titer AMA, if you're using an ELISA test, it was reported out as a number. The number can be, if to me, a number more than 40 or 50 is usually suspicious. And we also have specific assays that can you do immunofluorescence or immunofixation, and also obtain the other antibodies. Dr. Guillaume-Sain, what's your perspective on sort of a patient with a positive AMA where you don't see a cholestatic pattern and you're not suspecting PBC?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think your comment about modalities for treatment and the type of assay is relevant. The ELISA, as you mentioned, is cheap and easy to get now. And I think historically there's been cost associated with the immunofluorescence assay because it's technically a little bit more burdensome. So I think cost is less of an important factor, at least in our landscape currently. I think a lot of diagnosis for PBC depends on the pretest probability, right? You have to think about who is the patient or who is the person sitting in front of you. A middle-aged woman who has abnormal liver tests has approximately a 1 in 1,000 risk of having PBC, right? So that's uncommon, but not rare per se, right? So I think you have to think about the pretest probability and interpret the results in that context. You're right that in the wrong clinical context, i.e. an inpatient who has other medical things going on, an AMA might not be relevant and is probably a false positive. But the pretest probability is importantly relevant. That being said, I think a high level or a high index of suspicion is important, particularly in the outpatient to ambulatory setting, to avoid these delays in diagnosis that we're seeing more and more published and presented at meetings. Sort of median delays in diagnosis are somewhere between 3 and 4 years, and education is important for that. But I also think sort of thinking about PBC as a diagnosis is important as well.
Right. If you don't test for it, you're not going to make the diagnosis.
Absolutely.
And so if you have any question that the patient has PBC, it's better to get an AMA and then easier to discuss with one of us whether that AMA is clinically meaningful than not doing it at all. So I'm going to ask you an epidemiology question that came in. Said, what is the relative rarity of the other autoimmune diseases, such as PSC and autoimmune hepatitis, in comparison to PBC? Are they all common? So PBC, we think maybe about 75,000 people in the U.S., maybe 100,000 tops have it. For PSC, I think the number is probably half. Do you agree with those? And what are your thoughts about prevalence of autoimmune hepatitis?
Yeah, so I mean, it's hard. The epidemiology of these rare diseases is difficult because diagnostic modalities have changed over time, particularly related to PSC and the quality of MRIs. And education has changed, and maybe the actual true epidemiology has actually changed in terms of the true prevalence and incidence of disease. I sort of think about PBC as, I think you mentioned, or maybe Tuesday mentioned, that PBC is sort of an uncommon disease. It's an uncommon rare disease. And I think the incidence of PBC is somewhere about like 2 in 100,000. PSC is much more rare. I would agree that it's about half of that, so one in 100,000 or even less than that even. And autoimmune hepatitis, I sort of fit as somewhere in between those two. Maybe it's a little bit closer to PSC than PBC, but sort of in between. But it also depends on where you live in the world and how much these diseases are looked for, you know. So difficult epidemiology for rare disease, not specific to these. But I think sort of autoimmune hepatitis sits in between PSC and PBC.
Yeah, great answer. So I have two questions for Dr. Werner. The first is actually from a patient. And so we want to be able to, obviously we can't give advice to individual patients, but it raises some interesting questions. Had a fiber scan done today, it was F2 last December, which is a great improvement from previous F3, F4. Result today was 17.7. I don't know what that means. It is worsened, possibly because the patient moved and was not on Ocaliva for a few days, or Ocaliva is the brand name for obeticholic acid. So how would you interpret this, Dr. Werner, and how would you advise, give general comments based on this?
So for the score of 17, that's pretty high. Correlating it with the patient's clinical presentation, I would probably or make a follow-up with that, checking their liver numbers. At least for my experience, fiber scan varies. The result of it varies, depends on if there's anything accompanied with just the scarring. Maybe there's ascites, or maybe there's other things, or maybe even technical issues or operation from whoever's doing the procedure. Follow up fiber scan can be done. And again, this is all, staging thing that we can do. And again, comparing to the clinical presentation of the patient, I would highly probably recommend that you keep on being aware of the symptoms.
I would agree. And I would advise the person to just follow up with whoever. My guess is, this is purely guessing, obviously, because we don't know the details of the individual patient, is that the F2 was probably a falsely low number, and the patient probably has had a high number. And this is a number that would be in the range of F4. So I would definitely advise seeking care and getting a follow-up. One question is about, do delays in diagnosis stem from primary care clinicians not being up to speed, or are delays universal across specialties because PBC isn't thought about? So I think that's the whole purpose of a course and meeting such as this. We hope that this will increase awareness. And if you don't think about it, you're not going to test for it, especially, I think, for patients who have symptoms and don't have elevated liver enzymes, or liver enzymes were not tested, rather. Mm-hmm. And if you don't test it, you're not going to find it. So I would encourage everyone to really just, if it's a patient, be proactive and ask your physician to order a liver panel if you're itching. And if you have elevated liver enzymes, then certainly they should be thinking about PBC among other diagnoses. So Dr. Ghulam Hussain, I have an interesting question for you. I'm not sure there's a right answer, but I do think that we know the opposite of this. Does having cholestasis of pregnancy make you more prone for PBC? If so, when should the patient start diagnostic testing, and what should you do to prevent PBC? So we know that in patients with PBC, they're more likely to have worsening cholestasis during pregnancy. I'm not aware of any data that cholestasis of pregnancy, which is fairly common, is associated with an increased risk of PBC. Are you aware of any such data?
No, I'm not. I mean, I don't think that specifically related per se in terms of someone with ICP developing a higher risk of PBC, aside from the epidemiologic risk of a younger woman in that right demographic. So I think that the other way around, as you mentioned, is true, that those with PBC are at a higher risk of ICP than the other way around.
Great. Well, we've got time for, I think, one more question. And I'm going to ask Dr. Werner for this. Is Sickle syndrome a common manifestation of PBC? Are there recommended therapies for symptomatic relief? I think this is a very important practical question. And can you answer that, Dr. Werner?
Right. For Sickle dryness, my daughter have a Sickle syndrome. She's got dryness, but she doesn't have PBC. But obviously, it comes with a lot of autoimmune condition. So I'm not an expert on treating dry eyes or dry mouth, but I would most likely refer them to somebody that's more like a rheumatologist, maybe, or maybe a dentist, someone that can help with the symptoms of Sickle. But it's certainly, we need to address this. And if we do have a patient that have these symptoms, we can open the communication to help them, either referring them to specialists, consider all these over-the-counter treatment, and then go from there. But it's important that we really need to address this.
Yeah, excellent point. So good oral hygiene and eye mm-hmm. hygiene are important because corneal ulcers and dental ulcers can occur. Well, by way of summary, here are a few SMART goals that I would like to present to sort of summarize where we're at. And it's important, I think, based on this discussion to elevate PBC on the diagnostic radar, change the epidemiology of the changing epidemiology relates to improved awareness and enhanced diagnostics. I think we've all learned it's important to listen to our patients and avoid diagnostic delays, keep social drivers of health in mind. I think we can all become proficient very quickly at implementing non-invasive diagnostic pathways for PBC, evaluate complementary treatment strategies, and keep abreast of new drugs in development. So I do want to make sure that that I thank the audience for participating. And for the excellent questions, I want to thank Dr. Gulam Sain, Dr. Werner for their great presentations and clinical insights. And to receive CME credit for this activity, as shown in the slide, please complete the post-test evaluation online, then click on the Request Credit tab to complete the process. You can print your certificate. And for your colleagues who missed tonight's live event, there will be an enduring material that will be available as on-demand activity. And for more information and resources and education for both health professionals and patients, please visit the CME Outfitters Hepatology Hub. And thank you, everyone, and have a great evening.
Thank you.